Welcome to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Marty's off today. Pittsburgh found itself in the worldwide spotlight this past week as Uber launched its fleet of self-driving cars. The ride-sharing company has been easing residents and city officials into the transition for months with converted Ford Fusions cruising the city, sporting cameras and GPS units while mapping the streets of Pittsburgh. And while there's certainly been exhilaration about this next step in automotive technology, there's also caution. Uber sends a human safety driver along on each driverless outing, and the autonomous driving industry itself is still recovering from a fatal accident a few months back involving a partially automated Tesla. In addition, we'll hear more about new federal guidelines issued just this week. So, what is today's self-driving technology capable of, and when will we see driverless cars as a matter of course? If you'd like to weigh in, here's the number, 888-477-9499. You can send us an email at radiotimes@whyy.org, or a tweet works as well at WHYY Radio Times. Jason Lachlan is transportation writer for the Philadelphia Inquirer. And Jason took a ride recently in a Carnegie Mellon driverless car. Welcome to Radio Times, Jason.
Thank you.
Hope Reese is a staff writer for Tech Republic, an online publication which offers news and analysis of technology. Hello, Hope.
Hello, good morning.
And Costa Samaras is an assistant professor in the Department of Civil and Environmental Engineering at Carnegie Mellon University. Welcome, Costa.
Great to be with you.
So Jason, we're all curious. What was your experience like in the Carnegie Mellon self-driving car?
Yeah, so I took a ride in their Cadillac, which has been altered and installed with lasers and cameras and four separate computers. And the first experience is really unsettling. You're in there and the wheel is turning itself. And every time you come up to a stoplight or a stop sign, I started feeling kind of nervous, wondering, is this vehicle going to stop or is it going to run the light?
Sure.
So it is something that takes some getting used to, for sure.
Now, at this point, and Costa, let's bring you into the conversation. For the most part, with driverless vehicles, there is a human safety driver along for the ride, correct?
Well, that's a matter of state law, especially in Pennsylvania. If you're going to have a self-driving vehicle, there has to be a human driver behind the wheel to take over. And I think as a matter of course, you know, as these vehicles become more safe, as the technology improves, we'll slowly start to see state laws being changed to allow for completely driverless vehicles.
Hmm. Hope Reese, National Transportation Secretary Anthony Fox has just issued a policy paper for automakers as they move quickly to get this technology up and running. Right now, it's a patchwork from state to state as far as regulation is concerned, right?
Yes, that's correct. They are having a press conference today at noon where they'll be announcing some very specific guidelines in terms of safety, et cetera. But it is definitely a big step forward that they are fully embracing autonomous vehicles at this point and realizing that the technology has come to a point where the regulations are going to need to recognize that.
Jason Lachlan, have we heard anything ahead of time about what we might hear at noon today during this press conference?
Yeah, it sounds like what the federal government is looking at is being responsible for the software rather than the hardware, which is typically just a car. So they're looking at multiple points of reliability and the safety of the driver, which is going to be interesting to see how states interact with that. Right now, these are being described as guidelines. Pennsylvania particularly is really embracing this technology. As Costa mentioned, as far as I'm aware, the only major regulation that matters is that somebody has to be in the driver's seat. So it'll be interesting to see how Pennsylvania kind of absorbs these and incorporates them into its own laws as it moves forward, trying to figure out how to encourage this technology here.
Okay, so let's get back to the car itself and your story. As the person who is, I guess, telling the car where to go, what is it you do exactly?
Well, so I'm a passenger, and there was a Carnegie Mellon professor who is in the driver's seat. There was a pre-programmed route that this vehicle followed. There's a golf course in Pittsburgh that we started at and did a 5-10 minute loop kind of around that area, which was on open roads, and there was interaction with traffic and turns and lights and all of that. the vehicle, as I said, there's the pre-programmed route that it knows, but it also is reading its surroundings with lasers, cameras, and reacting to what's happening on the road around it. And eventually, down the line, he was saying, this professor, that they'd be more and more confident with just having sort of open road driving, not necessarily having this a circuit that the car would be following.
Does Uber have this yet, open road driving?
They are, my understanding is they are also following a certain closed area. So it is somewhat pre-programmed, the routes in Pittsburgh they're going through.
So can somebody jump in, though? I mean, it's an Uber service, so somebody wants to go, say, to the supermarket, and when that person gets into the car, there is the human person, the safety person, mm-hmm. but is there some sort of computer setup where you punch in where you want to go?
My understanding is it works the same as if you were calling an Uber, you would put in your destination, yep. and the vehicle would show up, and there's the driver, and there's also apparently a pad that the passenger can watch from the back seat and sort of see the route that the car is taking. And Uber also has a person in the front passenger seat that's watching data and observing kind of how the car is performing on this route.
So what led to that feeling of being a little disconcerted on your part?
You know, as you're, grow up driving, one of the most alarming things is when the driver doesn't have his hand on the wheel and is looking at you and not at the road, and you want to say, well, pay attention. But it takes some time to get over that.
To relinquish control.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. What's interesting, though, is according to the Dr. Raj Kumar, the professor I was traveling with, that feeling of sort of nervousness tends to fade away after 10 minutes. And one of the points that he made that I thought was really interesting was that's where things dangerous can happen.
Yeah.
Because the technology, and he emphasized this, and everyone I talked to on the kind of research side emphasized, it's not there yet. The driver really can't just stop paying attention right now. And there were a couple times where he had to take control of the vehicle. There was a knob sort of between the driver and passenger seat that he would turn, and that would allow him to grab the wheel and control the vehicle. And he had to do that more than once during, like I said, a 5 to 10 minute ride.
Mm-hmm. Hope Reese, so we're not at the point yet then when somebody can just flip the laptop on and get a little mm-hmm. bit of work done before they get to the office.
Right. And actually, I wanted to go back to that point about the comfort level, because I've also tested a couple of autonomous vehicles. I tried Tesla's Autopilot in May, and where I was actually, behind the wheel, which, of course, isn't a completely self-driving situation, but it is an autonomous feature. And that feeling of exhilaration, it was very present. But then, after just a few minutes, I felt completely comfortable. And then a week ago, I was in Ford's completely self-driving car, which was, I was in the back seat, and we were only going about 20 miles an hour versus 70. And the experience was so different, because although I did understand that the technology was so impressive, the actual experience had already kind of shifted for me, where I felt like this was something that felt normal in a way. So I do think it's a really important point that, remaining alert is kind of critical in these situations, and that's why they do have the safety driver, because people do tend to, maybe be afraid of the technology at first, but by and large become comfortable as soon as they have, even just a few minutes or a little bit of experience with it.
So you feel the comfort will settle in pretty quickly.
I think it will. And I think that is something that we all need to pay attention to and emphasize, especially in a situation where there's, kind of a semi-autonomous state, that the drivers do have a lot of responsibility to operate the vehicle according to the guidelines.
Costa Samaras, Jason had spoken earlier about, several times the safety driver had to kind of regain control of the car that he was in. What can these cars see, in quotations, and comprehend at this point? How do they avoid, the kid who's on a bike who's going to dart out in front of the vehicle?
Well, you and I, when we're driving in cars for our whole life, we kind of get used to what's happening on the road. A computer has to do that from scratch. So they will start to sense stop signs and traffic lights and intersections and other cars, but there's all types of unforeseen situations, a ball bouncing into the street, some ducks crossing the road, things that we would take for granted that, okay, we have to come to a stop. Well, a computer encounters that for the first time and has to recognize, okay, now I need to come to a stop. And I think as the technology of sensing and radar and deep learning improves, the computers will be able to better navigate the tricky situations of kind of urban intersections and traffic. And I do think that the comfort level is a really big deal. Google has said publicly that they don't want to have a steering wheel because they can't rely on the humans to take control in an emergency. And I think that it also could be a generational thing. If you imagine that all of us didn't grow up with smartphones, but today's children do. The other day in Pittsburgh, you know, at the school bus stop, we saw the Uber cars drive by. They drive by all the time. And the kids that were at the bus stop were cheering. They were going, Uber, Uber. And so these kids are growing up in a world where it's normal that there's going to be driverless cars. And I think that's a generational effect that'll take some time to sink in.
So, Costa, at this point, if an Uber in Pittsburgh is behind a school bus and the school bus stops to pick up a child for school, the driver does not take over in that situation?
Well, that would be on a case-by-case basis, I'm sure, for Uber. But my understanding is for most situations, they're taking over only when something out of the ordinary happens. Mm.
Let's get back to Google for just a moment, because as you mentioned, it's testing cars without steering wheels and I believe without pedals as well. So as far as regulation is concerned, then are the regulations going to be aimed at the manufacturer or the driver? Because if the driver doesn't have control, then who are we talking about here? Jason, what are your thoughts?
Well, you know, I think the Google example is an interesting one because, as Costa mentioned, they are aiming for a full autonomy. They don't think semi-autonomous vehicles are safe, period. And then their testing has found some of the same things that Carnegie Mellon mentioned, which was that after a period of time, you just cannot keep a person engaged if at the back of their mind they know the vehicle is going to be driving itself. Mm. And so they're to some extent sort of falling behind in the technology in some ways because they're aiming for a higher level of autonomy than a lot of other companies are settling for right now. It looks like, yeah, the federal regulations, to answer your question, are directed much more at the manufacturer than at the person. They've sort of said that licensing, inspection, insurance, that's all going to remain with the state, but they're looking at the technology and ensuring that the technology is safe.
All right. We're talking about the car of the future, which is here, the self-driving car. What do you think? Is this something you feel you could embrace? 888-477-9499 is the number. Jason Lachlan is transportation reporter for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Hope Reese, staff writer for Tech Republic. And Costa Samaras, an assistant professor in the Department of Civil and Environmental Engineering at Carnegie Mellon University. Stay with us. Radio Times continues after this. This is Radio Times on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, and we're talking about the self-driving car. It is here. Jason Lachlan is transportation reporter for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Constantine Samaras is an assistant professor in the Department of Civil and Environmental Engineering at Carnegie Mellon University. Hope Reese, a staff writer for Tech Republic. And we're taking calls at 888-477-9499. Also, you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And we do have some pictures up on our Facebook page of the Uber vehicle, the driverless vehicle, and that's at whyy.org/radiotimes if you'd like to check it out. If you would, Costa, describe the technology that sits atop, for the most part, the driverless car. What is it comprised of? How does it work? And some contain something called LiDAR, if not all. Could you get into that for us?
Sure. So the basics of how robot cars work is they use a sense, plan, act design. So they need to sense what's happening around them, plan what to do, and then act on that, turn the wheel, push the brake, step on the gas. And that's basically what we do as humans. We're looking around, we see something in the road, we make a plan, and we put our foot on the brake. The difference is that the computer is using LIDAR, the light detection and ranging, and radar and cameras and infrared and other sensing to instantly sense the world around them. And then the onboard processing makes that plan, and then some actuators or some other switches inside the vehicle turn the wheel. And so as the sensing technology has really improved in the last decade is really how this has come about to be a reality a lot quicker than a lot of folks have thought. Although I do want to stress, as we've been talking about before, there's kind of a varying degree of spectrum about who thinks that these cars are going to be on the road fully driverless in a few years versus multiple decades. And I think, you know, what I and what others have thought is that it's going to happen in segments of the roadway, so maybe on highways first, maybe in parking lots, maybe in traffic jams, and that will be in, you know, 5 to 10 years. But it might be 10 or more years before we see fully self-driving cars safe enough to navigate all roadways.
I was thinking about this, Cost, as I was driving over the Ben Franklin Bridge this morning. Jockeying for position is more like it. I just thought, how would a self-driving vehicle fit in here with in you know something that's heavily trafficked in which you really have to try to find your spot and able in order to be able to get off the bridge in the right position?
Well, that's going to be one of the most relieving benefits, I think, of these cars. And there's a lot of benefits and there's a lot of challenges. But one of the things is reducing some of that stress when you're in a stop-and-go traffic. And that's a situation on a bridge where there's nobody entering or exiting, and it's just the cars in front of you stopping and going, where we'll see that technology rapidly advancing in the next few years.
Hope Reese, some Uber engineers have apparently called the technology on top of the car a spinning chicken bucket. Not sure exactly what that is, but it's not very sleek. It's sizable. Guessing this technology will change at least in appearance fairly quickly?
I think it will, but I think at the moment they are very clear that this is really a research program. I mean, they're using these Uber drivers and passengers to collect data, and you know, this does differentiate the car from, you know, a different kind of Uber or a different car on the road. So in a way, it may have an advantage because other cars can spot it as a self-driving car. So I think they're not overly concerned about the appearance at the moment.
All right, let's get to some of those calls and comments. We have an email from Susan who asks, if autonomous cars become safer and more available, will those of us who love to drive have to stop? I know we will be more problematic in a time when a safer option is available. Jason Lachlan, what are you hearing?
Yeah, this is really a fascinating question. And you mentioned traffic on the Ben Franklin Bridge. So one of the things that's happening in Pittsburgh is not just the vehicles themselves, but teaching vehicles to talk to each other, vehicle-to-vehicle communication, teaching vehicles to communicate with the infrastructure, stop signs, stop lights, the highways. So eventually, everything will be communicating. So the kind of stop-and-go traffic that you're talking about won't really happen because all the cars will be in touch with each other and they'll find the most efficient way to get you to your route. And the kind of frightening future is you would be putting everybody else at risk if you were driving your car. And the equation works best if no one is driving their car and everything is sort of interacting in a Wi-Fi kind of communication system.
Costa Samaras, what do you think?
Yeah, there's going to be this long period of kind of hybrid robot-human interaction on the roadways. I think it's going to be our entire lives. It might even be our kids' entire lives. And there will be human drivers for a long, long time. However, in certain situations, you might want to have policies that have autonomous-only lanes, autonomous-only zones to increase safety in some areas. So there's a real balance and there's a real policy discussion to be had about when do we allow all autonomous vehicles on different parts of the roadways? When do we allow kind of hybrid mixed traffic? And Jason mentioned the vehicle-to-vehicle communication. It's also going to be vehicle-to-people communication. Your smartphone could communicate as you're walking or as you're cycling that you're in the middle of the road and that car comes to a stop. And that's a pretty big deal because last year is the first year that we've seen road fatalities in the U.S. go up in a long, long time, and they attribute that to distracted driving. Mm-hmm. So I think self-driving cars couldn't come at a better time. And that fatality number last year, 35,000 people on the road, that's about one 747 plane crashing every week. Yeah. So it's a really big public health issue,
yeah.
And pedestrians and cyclists are a big part of that. They were actually some of the biggest increases from last year.
Hope, let's get to the V2V communication. There have been concerns about hacking, as promising as this technology is.
Yes, that's true. And in fact, this brings up a good point, which is that the insurance whole insurance model around autonomous cars is going to rapidly be shifting. And instead of actually covering the hardware, it will probably shift to the software, the technology behind this, because one of the major concerns with this technology is the cybersecurity aspect. And that's also something that the DOT is going to be focusing on with their new guidelines.
All right, let's take some calls here on Radio Times. A self-driving car is the focus. And Joseph in Lansdale, you are live. Hi, Joseph.
Yes, I'm here. Thanks for taking my call. Simply what you were mentioning before, do you think it would be best that the automated cars should only be initially used for approved roadways, especially since many of them may be quiet or electric?
Oh, good question. Thanks for the call to Radio Times. Jason?
Yeah, it sounds like, and I think Costa mentioned this, that the way the rollout is foreseen is in very kind of limited environments first. So the first place you may see this kind of technology, full automation, is not going to even be on the road. It might be at an airport. It might be at a shipyard. And it's going to be kind of a gradual phase in. My understanding is that highway driving is actually easier for these kind of vehicles than the kind of navigating around a neighborhood that we might do just, you know, in a suburb. So I think it does make sense that it's just going to be a gradual sort of thing with some safe areas and some areas where it's still the person driving.
All right. And heading to the airport now, Brian is standing by. Welcome to Radio Times, Brian.
Yeah, I just think that there's a disconnect between the reality, especially where the liability is concerned with these cars. And the fact that, you know, I do drive for a living, I can tell you there's a lot of cars that are floating around out there that aren't up to standards, and people just drive them anyway. Now, how is that going to change when a driverless car is going to be even more expensive to keep up? And, I mean, down the road, I'm saying, how people are going to have to keep the radars perfect, and they're going to have to keep the sensors perfect. That means in bad weather. That means in snow. It means all these factors involved here that I never hear anybody talking about. It's always done on this idea that, you know, it's all going to work out. I just think there's a lot of little things that aren't little things that don't ever get talked about here. Right.
Brian, let's thank you for the call to Radio Times. We appreciate it. Costa Samaras, could you weigh in on that for us?
Yeah, Brian makes a really good point. You know, sensors fail. And things break. And making sure that the vehicles are safe every day is something that is going to be a responsibility of the states. It's the federal government has signaled in its new policy brief that they're going to be able to have some preemption in keeping these vehicles safe. And states who do inspections, like Pennsylvania, will still be able to do inspections. Maybe it's something that happens more often. If it's a self-driving vehicle, we won't mind so much sending it to the shop to get an inspection more than once a year.
All right. Jason Laughlin, Pittsburgh's mayor himself, has said there will be accidents.
Yeah. And one of the stats that you hear a lot is that of those 35,000 fatalities on the road that we have every year, 94% of those are caused by human error. That's a stat that the federal government brought up yesterday when they were unrolling these guidelines. And the people that are saying, let's get this technology on the road, are saying, yes, there will be accidents, but far fewer than what we have now. And right now, unfortunately, when there's a car crash, nobody's horrified by that and afraid to get in their cars. And they're saying that there's a process of acclimation. Well, we'll not be so alarmed if something does go wrong with this technology.
Hope Reese, what's your take?
Yeah, this is a really interesting issue because I think human or just public acceptance of autonomous cars is a huge hurdle to having them become adopted. And right now, we have a much lower tolerance for accidents when they happen in an autonomous vehicle versus just a normal driving situation. So, for instance, when Josh Brown's autopilot enabled Tesla crashed into a truck in May, that was a big news story. The thing is, there were so many factors involved in that, but the fact that it, you know, technology may have played a role in it. Made people fearful in a way that they wouldn't have been if, you know, someone just crashed, you know, by themselves or weren't paying attention to the road.
Hope, what was the determination as to the cause of that accident?
Well, so Tesla has just recently issued an update to their autopilot. So now they have 8.0, which Elon Musk said if Joshua Brown had been driving in this new autopilot system, the crash probably would not have happened. So the update is that it really can detect dense materials in front of it, and it would have braked sooner. The thing is, so there were just so many factors. The truck was driving, you know, right across the road. The braking didn't happen. Also, the driver behind the wheel was shown to not have been paying attention and using autopilot in the way that it was meant to be used.
It's not truly a hands-off system.
Correct. And that's something that I experienced myself. So when I was testing autopilot, the engineer next to me kept saying, you know, this isn't a self-driving car. You need to keep your hands on the wheel. And in fact, if I took my hands off of the wheel, the sensors would beep and I would be reminded to pay attention. That's also something with the new Autopilot 8.0. If a driver ignores those warnings to remain alert, the autopilot will turn off, so the driver is forced to pay attention in a way that they weren't before.
So, well, that sounds dangerous. So if the driver's, you know, doing something else or maybe has fallen asleep and is missing the signals, the autopilot just turns off?
Well, a driver falling asleep at the wheel is just a bad situation all around,
yeah.
Really, honestly. And that's like a big point about this Tesla autopilot. I'm constantly trying to kind of tell people this is more of an advanced cruise control. This isn't a self-driving car. If you turn cruise control on in your car, you don't, like, look away. You don't, you know, start watching a movie. You pay attention. So, like any technology, the way that you use it is really critical. And, you know, we have to make sure that people are following the guidelines and not completely trusting anything, because even as Tesla has said, the technology is still in a beta mode, and they want to emphasize that to make sure people know, you know, this is to help you stay safer in the car. This is not a foolproof method for driving, and this is definitely not a self-driving car.
Costa Samaras, how have companies and you know, Carnegie Mellon, which of course is on the cutting edge, those developing these vehicles reacted to the Tesla crash?
Well, I think a lot of them reacted with a little bit of hesitation, because the liability issue, as Jason was mentioning, is a big deal. So right now, you, the driver, is liable. And in a self-driving world, that liability is going to start to shift more and more towards the automaker. Maybe it shifts towards the sensor manufacturer. Maybe it shifts towards the programmer. And I think in the federal government's policy announcement, they started making signals towards addressing the liability issue the way that we've done other advanced technologies. But I think automakers are worried that high-profile incidents like Tesla could really affect public perception. And I think that is one of the big challenges of, as Hope was mentioning, of self-driving cars, is how is today's generation going to be okay with being the beta testers basically for their entire lives?
All right, let's get to David in Vineland, New Jersey. Quick question, David, before we head to the break. David, you with us?
Yes, I'm here.
Hi, we've got a moment or so before we get to the break, so let's hear your question.
Hey, my question is regarding all of this autonomous cars and everything. How will they be able to respond to vehicles that do not have the system, such as first responder vehicles or vehicles being driven by volunteer first responders whose driving habits will change in an instant depending on if they get a call or not?
All right. We appreciate the call to Radio Times, David. Jason Lachlan, you're nodding your head.
Yeah, I think one of the things that's as we may see this getting introduced, it actually may be those kinds of vehicles, buses, public vehicles that are going to be some of the first to have this technology, interestingly enough. I think kind of what that's getting around, and the previous caller asked the same kind of question, what we're going to have is a period of overlap. I mean, if you look at pictures from when automobiles were first introduced, they were sharing the road with horses. And that's today unthinkable. But at the time, that was normal, and it was this period of overlapping technology. And I think this will end up being something very similar, where for a long time, the state of Pennsylvania, some very large minority of the cars in the state are from 1995 and earlier, 20 years more old. And that's just how technology is introduced. There's going to have to be a period of overlap. There's going to have to be a period where these things interact, and then someday, you know, they'll be phased out. Yeah.
All right. We're talking about focusing on the self-driving car this hour of Radio Times. If you'd like to give us a call, get in the conversation, 888-477-9499. Jason Lachlan is transportation reporter for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Costa Samaras, assistant professor at Carnegie Mellon University. And Hope Reese is a staff writer for Tech Republic. Keep it here. There's more of Radio Times straight ahead. Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings. Jordan, the future is here. We are looking at the self-driving car this hour of Radio Times, and we're joined by Costa Samaras, assistant professor in the Department of Civil and Environmental Engineering at Carnegie Mellon. Hope Reese is a staff writer for Tech Republic, and Jason Lachlan is transportation reporter for the Philadelphia Inquirer. And we're taking calls at 888-477-9499, tweets at WHYY Radio Times. And Jason Lachlan, to you, Pittsburgh is, to my understanding, the first city in the world to allow an operation like Uber to commercially test a fleet of self-driving cars. Why Pittsburgh?
Pittsburgh has a variable climate around the year. It's got four seasons. It's got a very, you know, kind of hilly terrain. It has an urban area. So the people that are researching this say that this is sort of the ideal environment. If you can make it in Pittsburgh, you can make it anywhere. And a lot of the other places this is being tested in California and Texas have, you know, it's warm, it's dry. Pittsburgh is going to put a car through its paces more than a lot of other places in the country.
So it's home to about, what, 300,000 people.
Right.
It's a Rust Belt city.
Mm-hmm.
And early last year, the mayor, Bill Peduto, began to develop a relationship with Uber. He was actually pushing back against a proposed state ban against ride-sharing services at the time, and Uber's chief executive noticed.
Yeah, the mayor in Pittsburgh has been a huge advocate for this. I interviewed him last week, and he actually said he did not feel nervous riding in Uber's car. He did one of the test rides when they were introducing their technology. He sees this is the future, and he sees Pittsburgh in a position to benefit greatly from it. They're getting a lot of investment from the tech industry right now. Google is there, Uber is there, Bosch is there. It's a major part of their revitalization efforts. And a lot of the infrastructure in the city is getting improved at no cost to the city. There's a major amount of foundation money that's going into creating Pittsburgh as sort of a laboratory for these vehicles.
And Costa Samaras, in doing research for the show, I'd read that Carnegie Mellon and its robotics department were part of the draw. And in a strange sort of flattery, I'm hearing Uber might be attempting to raid Carnegie Mellon for its own purposes.
Well, Carnegie Mellon is the birthplace of the modern autonomous vehicle, and there's been a long history of excellence in robotics here at the university. And it really started to accelerate the technology through DARPA, the Defense Research Organization, that had a couple challenges of can you build an autonomous vehicle to navigate an urban area or a desert? And Carnegie Mellon won one of those challenges in the mid-2000s, and really it started to spin up from there. And with regards to Uber locating here, you know, companies want to be around places where they can draw great talent. And Pittsburgh, with our universities and our tech companies here, has been a good story for them and a good opportunity for them to be able to attract high capacity workers.
So, how would you describe Carnegie Mellon's relationship? Them characterize it with Uber.
Oh, well, I would say it's something of a good relationship that builds on each other's strengths.
Okay. Let's get back to comments and calls. Pam says, I remain skeptical, especially since there seems to be a very real danger of increased inattentiveness. However, I have lost two friends in the last month when their vehicles were struck by other drivers who were at fault, and another acquaintance was paralyzed. Numerous times, drivers have put my life in danger as I ride my bike or try to cross at the crosswalks of Philly. People alternate between driving as if in a competition to get someone. Somewhere probably in which other people are in their way and being utterly inattentive. So right now, the love of driving cuts no ice with me. It sounds, I hope, Reese, as if, like a lot of people, Pam is on the fence here.
Yes. I just want to make one quick point before I respond to Pam. Pittsburgh isn't the first city in the world to have the technology. Singapore actually has self-driving taxis, and that was announced just a couple of weeks before Uber's announcement. So they actually beat Uber to it.
Wow.
A similar situation, just to clarify that. But I understand Pam's sentiment there. What I hear often from people who are supportive of autonomous driving is that, you know, drivers on the road are really not that great, and they feel safer using their Tesla Autopilot than without it. So even kind of younger drivers who you would think safety may not be the number one criteria for purchasing a car, they seem to say that they really feel that this kind of technology is actually helping them prevent accidents that could happen if, you know, they completely just rely on themselves even to drive their own car.
Mm-hmm. And one more question regarding Pittsburgh before we move on. Jason Lachlan, there's been criticism that there's really very little regulation by the city of Uber and this fledgling technology. The assistant chief of police, Scott Schubert, is quoted as saying, there's really not been a whole lot of collaboration on the actual testing. So is this criticism justified?
You know, I don't know that I'm in a position to affirm or deny that. I okay. do know that people in academia are somewhat uneasy with some of the ways that this has been rolled out there. As we said, Mayor Peduto is definitely a booster. Dr. Raj Kumar of Carnegie Mellon said that he was alarmed that Uber was allowing reporters to sit in the driver's seat during that experience. He's fairly conservative about the technology, but there is a sense that what Uber doing? Is it a publicity stunt? Is it pushing things a little bit beyond where they actually are right now? I think the federal guidelines that are being introduced are going to go a long way towards giving states, if not the companies, sort of some framework for regulating and making sure that this is safe.
And we should, again, hear more about that later today.
Right.
All right. Jim in Cheltenham is waiting to go on the air. Jim in Cheltenham, welcome to Radio Times.
I'm wondering about how the priorities in the safety program will be structured. So, in other words, a child or a drunken person or whatever dashes out in front of your car, is the will the car be programmed to jam on the brakes to protect them, even at peril of the owner of the car who bought the technology, and perhaps at the peril of the three children in the car behind you that the program can predict, given their rate of travel and their distance from you, is going to slam into you. So, you know, who's going to get protected and what's going to be the calculus that that determines that?
Thank you, Jim. Costas Maris, how are engineers grappling with that question?
So there's a lot of articles written about this kind of exact types of scenarios where what happens, should we hurt the driver? Should we hurt people on the sidewalk? You know, what we do in my first year engineering class is stress the importance of engineering ethics. And all engineers are bound, you know, by their professional societies to kind of not hurt people. And what we have to do is make sure that engineers who are programming these things, you know, have those first principles in mind. And I think also the companies and the government in regulating these vehicles need to come to some open and transparent standards in the way that we're going to code and make decisions. But I do think the larger point is that even with today's technology that you can buy right now, one of our studies had found that you know, up to 10,000 of the 35,000 fatalities could be avoided. So while it's important to understand the larger implications around these interesting cases that we might be able to imagine, the big picture here is that automated vehicles represent a huge improvement in safety overall for the U.S. and for the world, and we have to keep our mind on that.
All right. Again, Jim, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Heading to Royersford, Pennsylvania now, we go to Ben. Hi, Ben.
Hi. Thank you so much for taking my call.
Sure.
My question is, I've been looking closely at this autonomous vehicles, and particularly in Pittsburgh. And there hasn't been any mention whether these are electric or gasoline. Looking at the pictures, it looks like they might be plug-in electrics. Is this future aligning itself with electric vehicles, or is it going to be traditional gasoline vehicles?
Interesting. We appreciate it, Ben. Jason Lachlan, what have you heard?
You know what? That's a great question. In my fascination and fear of the technology, I actually did, that is not something that came up. So
yeah. I haven't seen it either.
Yeah.
Hope Reese? So,
I do know that they're using Ford Fusions, although Uber doesn't have an actual alliance with Ford at this point, and they've invested in Volvo. I believe that they will move in that direction. I believe that the autonomous technology is going to start going hand in hand with electric. Especially as Tesla pushes automakers in that direction, trying to become sustainable. So I see it moving that way, although I don't think there's a clear answer.
Costas Samaras, did you want to weigh in?
Yeah, the vehicles that we've seen here in Pittsburgh by Uber are plug-in electric vehicles. And in our 2014 RAND report, we mentioned that there's a natural synergy between autonomous and electric vehicles. You send the vehicle off to recharge more often. You can have potentially a smaller battery. There's lots of efficiency. And really, we think that this nexus between automation and electric vehicles is one of the big ways we'll be able to not only improve safety, but reduce some of the climate and air pollution impacts of driving.
Oh, so there's a side effect, a positive side effect in less air pollution. Okay, we've got an email from Dustin who says, I'm an Uber driver. The most difficult part of ride sharing is the pickup and drop-off. Any Uber user knows the most difficult part is finding the person, inaccurate pickup locations, finding the car, etc. And Costas Maris said, do you know much about how Uber is handling that piece of the question, of the puzzle?
No, that's an important point. My understanding during the testing period that they're rolling it out to kind of high-volume users, people who have purchased a lot of Ubers in the past, what I kind of called the Willy Wonka golden ticket approach to this, in that you have to buy lots of regular rides in order to get a ticket into the autonomous Uber. I don't know how the handshake is going to work, but I imagine it's going to be obviously through your phone, and I think that is something that's going to be able to be worked out.
We've got an email from Mark who asks, what will be the effect on drunk driving? Hope Reese, you want to speculate?
I think, you know, this will definitely have an effect on those kinds of accidents. Just the fact that people can rely on, you know, automatic braking and sensors instead of getting behind the wheel intoxicated. I do know that I'm not sure there's going to be a clear correlation. I know that people also said that having Ubers available would also reduce drunk driving, just having it as a service, and I don't believe that that did happen. Mm-hmm. So I'm interested in everyone else's thoughts on that as well. But I think in general, drunk driving as well as any other kind of accidents are going to be reduced by autonomous technology.
And I imagine, Jason Lachlan, again, this is down the road when you get to fully automated technology in which it's okay for the driver to not pay attention.
Yeah, I think it's something that's worth noting that I don't think we've talked about yet is how many, potentially down the line, how many more drivers this could create. Hopefully not a bunch of drunk people riding around on the highways, but elderly people. I have an older relative who lost her car recently because she just wasn't safe for her to be driving. People with disabilities, people with vision impairments, all of these people down the line, and we don't know how far down the line, could potentially start having personal vehicles or access to a personal vehicle that would give them a lot more mobility than they have right now with public transportation or other means.
So people will be able to have their own cars and use their own cars who might be challenged at for the moment, but will we call them drivers down the road?
Yeah, they should just be users. And another possibility, and this is all kind of conjectural, but one of the other possibilities of this technology is that personal car ownership wouldn't really exist anymore, that you would have fleets of self-driving Ubers or whatever the future company is, and you would just order your ride, and that's how people would get around. And the idea of owning a car would sort of become a thing of the past.
Costa Samaras, what do you think?
Well, I think the next 5 years is a really important time for the way that we approach policy and planning with regards to these vehicles. As Jason was saying, mobility for seniors and folks with medical conditions is going to be dramatically improved. And we have a new study that's coming out that notes that and says that lots of new people will be able to have access that they had never had before. But it also depends on how we want our cities to look like. Will we have dense urban cores with shareable autonomous electric taxis, or will there be deep exurbs where people live 200, 300 miles away and kind of spend the first couple hours of the day in their car office and take meetings over lunch and then drive home? So there's a lot of different ways that this future could play out, and I think it's up to kind of stakeholders and policymakers to guide the ways that people want.
And Hope Reese, as we wrap up the hour, any final thoughts from you?
Yes, we haven't talked about this, but I do think it's important to remember the Uber drivers themselves and the kind of shift that may happen eventually because of this autonomous technology. Right now, I think Uber is offering these autonomous rides for free, at least for a starting period. So, you know, when we think about the technology, I think it's important to think about the people that are affected by it as well. Some of the Uber drivers I've spoken with are a little bit fearful of, you know, what will happen with their jobs and how they'll be affected by it.
Well, Hope Reese, thank you so much. That was a good point. Thanks for bringing it up. Hope is a staff writer for Tech Republic. And Acosta Samaras, it was a pleasure. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Costa is an assistant professor in the Department of Civil and Environmental Engineering at Carnegie Mellon University. And Jason Lachlan, we appreciate it as well. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Jason is the transportation reporter for the Philadelphia Inquirer. And as always, we invite you to take a look at our Facebook page. You'll find one of those self-driving Uber cars posted there today. And just head to whyy.org/radiotimes for that. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Thanks so much for tuning in.